something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, hello, and welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby. And I'm your host, she who is trying and failing to pull her life back together, Liv. Turns out it's really hard to be a functioning adult when your body is getting over being like royally fucked up by a virus. And personal traumas and tragedies collide, and the world is watching innocent people get murdered and doing nothing about it because the Western world doesn't play fair. Add to that being a hypersensitive and justice and fairness obsessed neurodivergent, and Jesus fuck, you've got a recipe for crippling and constant anxiety. And apparently the desire to voice it into a microphone. You are welcome. Pushing right past that onslaught of information. Hi, I hope everyone's just able to do their best right now. I am here again, and we are once more returning to everyone's favorite tragedian, unless they are wrong, Euripides. Thank the gods for Euripides. And gods, have I ever got a conversation coming for all of you? It's not even coming until next year, honestly, but I've just recorded it with a returning guest to talk all things Greek theater, the festivals and the process and the culture of it all. And of course, it includes so much fawning over Euripides. Big surprise. Cannot wait for you to hear that, but not for a while, because I'm getting ahead of myself. First, a reminder that if you are interested in learning more about the first ever official Myths Baby group trip to Greece, you only have a few more days to get your name in. Visit mythsbaby.com/group trip to find the form that you need to fill out for more information, or just to confirm that you are interested in this trip or future trips. And as I do every year, I will be doing a New Year Q&A episode on January 9th. So get your questions, comments, notes in now. It is mythsbaby.com/questions for that one. You all know how much I love hearing from you and just like the thought-provoking questions so that I can ramble on in my answers. It's so much fun. I love those episodes. And as always, both links are in the episode's description. So, you know, for easy clicking purposes. But for now, let's return to Iphigenia, where we last left Clytemnestra's not-quite-sacrificed daughter. She was priestess of Artemis, living amongst a group of people called the Taurians. And as we heard from Herodotus last week, there are some serious stigmas associated with these Taurians in Greece. And while we know they did exist in that particular location, we don't need to believe the weird things that Herodotus claims that they got up to. Except, well, Euripides was definitely inspired by those things in this play. They are not irrelevant here. Herodotus, though, he's a fascinating source. He is incredibly relevant and insightful when it comes to the ancient world broadly, like who lived where and when and with whom. But, well, he was still a Greek guy wandering around, and they could be a little judgy about those who weren't Greek. But gods, if he isn't invaluable in sorting out who was powerful and when and where and in the ancient Mediterranean all over, circa, you know, 5th century BCE. Thank you, Herodotus. So Iphigenia has found herself with these Taurians, who, in this play at least, well, have a nasty habit of human sacrifice. They have a real thing for sacrificing any Greek who lands on their shores, or even, like, sails by and is unlucky enough to be caught by them. Iphigenia, as this priestess, against her will, is always expected to prepare these men for their sacrifice. She doesn't have to kill them herself, it seems, but that doesn't stop her from harboring a lot of the blame for their deaths. This is what she has spoken about to the audience alongside a premonition that her brother, Orestes, is dead. But Orestes isn't dead. In fact, after he killed their mother for killing their father and was hounded by those dreaded furies, he and his best pal, Pylades, ended up exactly where Iphigenia is. Instructed by Apollo's oracle that the only way to stop the torment is to steal a cult statue of Artemis from Iphigenia's own temple and bring it back to Athens. Of course, they haven't seen each other yet. Euripides does love a surprise reveal. But Iphigenia's just been told by a local herdsman that two Greek men have been captured nearby, and they're going to need to be prepared to be sacrificed. You're up, Iphigenia. And gods, I wonder who these two Greek men are. This is episode 239. No one does a dramatic sibling reveal quite like Euripides. The herdsman who's been speaking with Iphigenia about these two young Greek men who have been found down by the shore has very different priorities from her. She wants to know who they are. She wants to know just a little bit about which of her fellow Greeks are about to fall victim to these Taurians with her reluctant help. The herdsman, on the other side, is just pointing out what's to come next. She's going to be needed soon. That's all. It's her job to prepare them for sacrifice. You don't know anything about them? Iphigenia asks. Nope, the herdsman says. Just that they're Greeks. No names? She clarifies. Oh, he says, like it's an afterthought. One of them called the other one Pylades. But, well, Pylades means nothing to Iphigenia. He is her brother's friend, but she's been believed dead and gone since her brother was a baby. She knows nothing about him, let alone his friend's names. The audience, though, and us? Oh, we get the suspense that Euripides is building. They speak about how the men were found. The herdsman was down by the sea with others, bathing their oxen, when they came across the two men. Iphigenia wants details, though. She asks him to tell her everything about how they were found, because, quote, it's been a long time since the goddess's altar ran red with Greek blood. So the herdsman does. He explains that they were down there by the water, near where it flows through the famed clashing rocks, the rocks that very nearly bested the Argo itself. There was a cave there, built into the rocks by the sea, and that's where one of the herdsmen spotted these two men. He snuck back to the others, whispering, first believing that the two men might be gods themselves. And another, hearing this, began to pray, quote, son of the sea goddess Leucothea, protector of ships, Lord Palaemon, be gracious, whether those are the twin sons of Zeus there, or some sweet offspring of Nereus who bore the 50 dancing daughters. Bit of a leap, but it was a beautiful quote. Another man speaks up. He was less pious than that one, and suggested that the men that were spotted in the cave were probably just shipwrecked sailors, rather than gods of the sea. He says they're probably just hiding, scared. Quote, no doubt they've heard we slaughter strangers. The others agree with this. It makes the most sense, the herdsman recalls to Iphigenia. So they decided to just sacrifice them, as usual. But, he explains, that's when one of the men came out of the cave all wild, throwing his head around and yelling and howling and shaking, and the herdsman says that the man started crying out to his friend, saying, quote, see that one, Pylades? And there, that snake of hell, look, she's itching to kill me, her horrible snakes are mouthing out at me, and this one's belching fire and death and thrashing her wings. We know what they don't know. Orestes is seeing the Furies, surrounding him, lashing out in ways that only he can see and experience. He's cried out to Pylades for help, afraid that this Fury is going to kill him. But the herdsmen, they were just confused. The one explains to Iphigenia that whatever this man was crying out about, whatever had him so terrified, wasn't visible to them. So they sat, waiting, expecting that this man was certainly about to just die. But he didn't. Instead, he pulled out his sword and started attacking the cattle around him, quote, fantasizing he was driving off the Furies. Seeing him killing their cows, the herdsmen armed themselves against this wild man who seems so lost in his own mind. They were ready to fight him, a crowd of them gathered, but there was no need. He tells Iphigenia that eventually, quote, the stranger let go the pulse of his frenzy and dropped to the ground. Foam dripped off his chin. That's when they attacked him, while his friend tried to protect him, to wipe the foam from his mouth and shield him from the wounds that the herdsmen were attempting to inflict. They tried to take them out, but eventually the man jumped up and called to his friend that if they were going to die, they were going to do it well. They pulled out their swords and prepared to defend themselves, and that's when all the herdsmen fell back. They didn't have swords, only whatever they could find, rocks and other things. They were no match for actual weapons. But they did their best, and eventually, he explains to Iphigenia, they very unheroically won against these two men, waiting them out, surrounding them close enough to rip their weapons from their hands. And so defeated, the herdsmen brought the two strangers, the Greeks, to the king of the Taurians, quote, who took one look at them and dispatched them here for you to wash and sacrifice. The herdsman is excited now. He's even happy for Iphigenia. He tells her that these are exactly the victims she should have been hoping for. Quote, execute them and Greece will really be paying you back for your own murder, paying the price for that slaughter at Aulis. Iphigenia has little to say to him. Fine, she says to the herdsman, go bring them here and then we'll prepare them for the sacrifice and perform our sacred duties. But when the herdsman leaves and Iphigenia turns to the chorus of Greek women, kept there to support her in this temple, but equally at odds with the Taurians who keep them, that's when she shows how she really feels. Quote, oh, my poor breaking heart, once you were kind and compassionate to strangers, you always spared them a kindred tear when they were Greeks. But dreams have ensavaged me. Iphigenia is dealing with some heavy shit. She doesn't want to hate all the Greeks, doesn't want to be the one sentencing these random Greeks to death, but she's angry with some of them, and rightfully so. She says something to the chorus of Greek women that feels quite real, even now. Quote, our own bad luck does not make us benevolent toward those who are worse off. She goes on. She talks about what her own fate has been like. And remember, she's been there among the Taurians for, well, like, it's tough to have a complete timeline, but it's certainly longer than the 10 years that there was the war. It's also enough time that her little brother, Orestes, who was only a baby when she was brought to be sacrificed at Aulis, is now a grown man. And she talks about how in that time there has been no contact from Zeus, no ship carrying Helen and Menelaus, quote, to pay back what they did to me. They murdered me to make an Aulis here, for that Aulis there, where the Danaans laid their hands on me as if I were a sacrificial calf, and my own father, the sacrificing priest. She talks about her mother back in Argos, how she'd been preparing for her daughter's wedding, not her death. Iphigenia was meant to marry Achilles, the best of the Greeks, not to be sacrificed like an animal. She calls what her father brought her to, quote, a wedding of blood. Iphigenia talks about all that she has missed by being sacrificed. She may not have been dead, but it wasn't so different, given she missed out on everything that was meant to be her life. She never got to hold her baby brother, even, and now she thinks he's dead. She talks about having put off so many things, thinking she was headed to her wedding and would have more time. She talks about where she is now, how the people, and even in some ways Artemis herself, are murderous. She makes a point even to say that she doesn't think it has anything to do with the curse on her family, with that banquet where Tantalus fed the gods his own son. No. Quote, the people here are murderous themselves, this is my opinion, so they ascribe base behavior to their deity. No god is evil. I do not believe it. The chorus sings. They sing of the sea, of the deep blue of the ocean that was crossed to reach that land in the east. They call it the hostile sea. They talk about the men who they believe as having left the Greek world themselves and settling there in, quote, this implacable country where the altars and temples of Zeus's daughter are doused with human blood. They sing of their ships, the wind that brought the men there to become the Taurians, and for what reason? Was it for riches? Greed? Gods, isn't every terrible thing about that in the end? What state-sponsored murder, sacrifice of innocence, isn't tied to wealth? They sing of the journey, the clashing rocks, and they sing of the sea and all its deities. They sing their prayer, that they agree with Iphigenia. They hope that Helen herself will sail there so that Iphigenia can get her revenge. Of course, it's not Helen's fault, but they can't see that. In the end, everyone's been convinced that the war is about something entirely different from the truth. Propaganda, at its best. The villainizing of Helen, when there are far more logical places to put one's blame. They sing of longing for their homeland and what that's like to have it ripped away from you, where their family is from for generations, which they've been driven from by others. They want the happiness of their own homeland, of their people, of what's always been theirs. And then they see the two Greek men being brought captive by Taurian guards. I call them men, with the understanding that that's what they are, that they're over 18, and we would rightly call them adults, or at least in this world that they've gone through their coming of age to be adults, in whatever way that was, so long ago. That's a large part of Euripides' other play about them. But I want to be careful, too, because sometimes children are wrongfully referred to as adults when people want to make them seem more complicit. More at fault and deserving of punishment. People who are under 18 are children, no matter where they're from. And as we all well know from the end of the Trojan War, the killing of children, even under the guise of war, is one of the worst crimes humanity can commit. Of course, when Iphigenia sees Orestes and Pylades, she doesn't know who she's looking at. Not only has she not seen her brother since he was a baby and wouldn't possibly be able to recognize him, but she is living under the impression that he's dead, that she should be mourning his loss. So instead of being capable of making the connection that it is her very own brother that's being brought before her, bound for sacrifice, she just goes through the motions. She does her duty, but she's on autopilot, at least when she's in front of the guards. She does, however, make clear to the guards that they need to be untied, these men. Quote, "They are sacred and should not be bound. They've been taken captive by this imposed authority without having committed a crime. They might not be children, but that doesn't make such a thing morally acceptable. There's been no trial, no sentencing, and thus they are technically not prisoners." No matter what an authority wants to say. And with that, she sends the guards away. With the guards gone, Iphigenia turns to the Greek men before her. Quote, "Ah, pity! Who is the mother who bore you? The father? The sister? Have you a sister? Robbed of two young men like you, she will be brotherless now." Then she talks about luck, how no one can know what will befall them, how the gods' plans are unknown. But she keeps speaking with them, asking where they're from. And so Orestes responds.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Orestes responds to Iphigenia, but of course he's not going to tell us who he is or where he's from. That would be too easy. Instead, he says, quote, "Why do you lament these things and vex yourself over troubles of ours, woman, whoever you are?" He points out that it makes no sense that she cares anything for them, given she's going to be the cause of their deaths. He doesn't want to be pitied. He knows what's coming. And then Iphigenia asks which of them is Pylades. Because Euripides is going to drag this out for as long as he can, the man knows how to build suspense for of a reveal that everyone else knows is coming. Orestes responds, tells her that it's the other one of them who's Pylades. So she asks what city in Greece he's from. But Pylades doesn't get the chance to answer, Orestes does, and he's defensive. Quote, "What good will it do you to know this, woman?" "Are you brothers?" she asks instead. To which Orestes replies, quote, "Brothers in love, we're not related." And yes, there's a lot to be said about what kind of relationship Orestes and Pylades have, but today we are more concerned with what's coming. Iphigenia asks Orestes what his name is. He says he should just be called Unlucky. "That wasn't my question," she replies. To which Orestes says, quote, "My body, not my name, is what you plan to sacrifice." And we and the audience just watched that tension grow and grow, threatening to burst. Iphigenia presses him again, but he only says that if he dies nameless, he'll avoid the shame. He won't tell her where he's from either. He doesn't see the point. But finally, when she asks him, like, what is preventing him from just saying it, he tells her, quote, "Glorious Argos is the home I claim." And so that tension eases just a little. Iphigenia asks him, shocked, "Is that really where you're from?" He confirms, "Yes, I'm from Mycenae." And Iphigenia softens a little. She tells him that he's very welcome if he's from Argos. But he just scoffs, maybe in your mind, not mine. She asks him why he's left. Is he in exile? Orestes says, quote, "A kind of exile, willing and unwilling at once." Iphigenia, hesitant, asks him, quote, "Will you tell me something I want to know?" He kind of says, "I mean, maybe it will distract me." So she starts her questions. Slowly, that tension's gotta build back up. "You've heard of Troy," she begins. Orestes wishes he'd never heard the name. "Is it really gone?" she asks. He confirms it. "Helen's returned then to her husband?" "Oh, yes," he says, quote, "and her going brought harm to one of mine." Iphigenia wants to know where Helen is now, says she owes her a debt, too. "She's in Sparta," he confirms, and the pair spend a moment hating Helen, blaming the victim for something she had no control over. A war she didn't start or fight in or determine in any way. Blaming her for blood she didn't spill lives she didn't have any hand in ending. Gods, you know, one of the earliest forms of really productive propaganda about a war has got to be Helen. The way she is blamed, despite having basically no role in any of it. And just for generations, she gets blamed. The whole world believes Helen to be at fault. Because propaganda works. Until there's enough access to a more accurate representation of what that war was all about. They go on. Iphigenia wants to know so many details about the return of the Achaeans from Troy. She tells Orestes she wants to get as much out of him as she can before he dies. He's fine with it. Ask away, he says. She asks about Calchas first, the prophet who told her father it was she who had to die to get them to Troy. He's dead, Orestes says. Good, she exclaims. How about Odysseus? He's believed alive, Orestes notes, but he's not home yet. To which Iphigenia replies, quote, may he perish and never reach home. And Orestes says she needn't bother with that curse. Things aren't looking good for Odysseus as it is. What about Achilles? She asks next. He's dead, Orestes says, before adding, quote, a futile marriage he made at Aulis. A futile marriage he made at Aulis. That's what Orestes told Iphigenia, referring to her very own false marriage, her sacrifice when confirming the death of Achilles at Troy. To which she says, quote, a travesty of marriage, so people say who suffered it. So people say who suffered it. What the fuck did I say about Euripides being an absolute badass at building the tension? Jesus. And rightly, this is a statement that's got Orestes questioning who it is that he's talking to. Quote, who are you? Your questions about Greece are strangely apt. I'm from there, Iphigenia tells him. Quote, was lost as a child. Then it's normal you would want to know about it, he says. But she's not done, Iphigenia then asks, quote, and what of the general, the one they called blessedly happy? Who did they ever call that? Orestes asks. So she says it outright, quote, a son of Atreus, King Agamemnon, was so called. I can only imagine how this bit was played out, this reveal that is not yet a reveal, and yet which everyone knows is coming, and everyone knows who they're watching interact for the first time, like these two siblings who don't know that they're siblings, brother and sister, whose lives have been utterly destroyed by that Trojan War, by their families, who have just no idea that they're being reunited under still more tragic circumstances. Orestes won't answer that question, though. He asks to change the subject instead. No, Iphigenia insists. You have to answer that question. He's dead, Orestes grits out. And he wasn't alone in his death. Iphigenia was not ready to hear this. She's distraught and she wants to know how it happened. But Orestes just wants to know why the fuck she cares. Then he tells her, he was murdered by his wife. And Iphigenia's reply is complicated. Quote, oh, there are tears in this for the killer and the killed. But Orestes, he doesn't want to talk about it anymore. He doesn't want her asking any more questions, except Iphigenia can't help herself. She has just one more. Quote, is the poor man's wife alive? No, Orestes says. Quote, her own son killed her. Well, that's it for this play today. We're going to continue next week. But before we finish off this episode, I've decided that, like, I really want to give you a quick reading from Herodotus's history. You know, I've been reading a little bits of it for this, and he's really interesting. He's just really interesting. I'm really interested in the geography of the Mediterranean in 5th century BCE. Why not? Geography is so fun. And thankfully, Herodotus is a chill guy who gave us a description of who was living in that region those 2,500 years ago, this ancient geography. Now remember, Herodotus, he is called the father of history because he is the earliest surviving source for someone who traveled around the ancient Mediterranean, writing about the people that he met there and their stories. He might have had some wacky ideas about what some of them actually, like, lived their lives like, but gods, he was good at describing who was where and when. Now, the bit I'm interested in sharing today is Herodotus laughing at an ancient map maker who he saw as really, like, having no idea what they were doing. So in his final book of his histories, he decided to lay out a detailed description of how he determined the map of the Mediterranean region would be, based on all of his travels and determining who was where. Of course, to him, you know, the ancient Mediterranean region is basically the whole world, but we can safely say now that in this case, he's talking about southeastern kind of Europe, East Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa. So here's how he describes this 5th century CE map of that whole region. Lots of the names won't be familiar, you know, some things have changed in 2,500 years. And these are English translations of original Greek names, so sometimes we have a more Latinized version of them. But there are sure lots of places that you'll recognize. Because particularly in this region, as we can tell with everything I talk about every week, many groups of people have been there a really long time. So this is Herodotus from book 4 of his histories. I've linked to it in the episode's description if you want to check it out. In a few words, I shall declare the size of each division and of what nature it is as regards outline. The Persians inhabit Asia, extending to the southern sea, which is called the Erythraean, and above these, towards the north wind, dwell the Medes, and above the Medes, the Sasparians, and above the Sasparians, the Colchians, extending to the northern sea, into which the river Phasis runs. These 4 nations inhabit from sea to sea. From them westwards, 2 peninsulas stretch out from Asia into the sea, and these I will describe. The first peninsula, on the one of its sides, that is the northern, stretches along beginning from the Phasis and extending to the sea, going along the Pontus and the Hellespont as far as the Sigeon in the land of Troy. And on the southern side, the same peninsula stretches from the Mariandrian Gulf, which lies near Phoenicia, in the direction of the sea as far as the headlined Triopion, and in this peninsula dwell 30 races of men. This, then, is one of the peninsulas, and the other, beginning from the land of the Persians, stretches along to the Erythraean Sea, including Persia, and next after it, Assyria, and Arabia after Assyria, and this ends, or rather is commonly supposed to end, at the Arabian Gulf, into which Darius conducted a channel from the Nile. Now, in the line stretching to Phoenicia from the land of the Persians, the land is broad and the space abundant. But after Phoenicia, this peninsula goes by the shore of our sea along Palestine, Syria, and Egypt, where it ends, and in there are 3 nations only. These are the parts of Asia which tend towards the west from the Persian land, but as to those which lie beyond the Persians, and Medes, and Sasparians, and Colchians towards the east, and the sun rising on one side of the Erythraean Sea runs along by them, and on the north both the Caspian Sea and the river Araxes, which flows towards the rising sun, and Asia is inhabited as far as the Indian land. But from this onwards, towards the east, it becomes desert, nor can anyone say what manner of land it is. Really interesting, right? I mean, I love that he has absolutely no grasp on the entirety of Asia beyond, which is freaking enormous. But so interesting, right, to hear that 5th century BCE map of the ancient Mediterranean. So many recognizable places still have the same names as they did, sometimes coined by Herodotus, actually. A lot of these, some of these names were actually the first uses appear in this first historian. Ugh, nerds, 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 thank you so much for listening, as always. I am so glad to be back working on these episodes for you all. It is wild just trying to, like, pull my ADHD brain back into the swing of things while also, like, I swear, I could not have more pieces of my life and the world around me just, like, colliding into a mess all at once. But here we are. I managed this episode, and I think I did it okay. This play is seriously interesting. Like, I forever want to cover all of the plays that Euripides wrote about women and the shit they went through in life, but also the mythology, but also the whole dynamic between Iphigenia and Orestes up to this point has been fascinating. Like, their conversation and questions were so good, and truly, like, Euripides just knows how to build the fucking tension, despite the fact that everyone watching this play would know who is on this stage, right? Like, they are so aware of what is happening, and yet he builds this tension in this such a satisfying way. I'm just fucking here for it. I'm also so here for ancient geography. It's nerdy as shit. I love it. Like, that's definitely the only reason that I wanted to just read some Herodotus. This ancient geographer who named all these places that were around 2,500 years ago. It's definitely that. It's not that I don't feel like I can say other things on here without risking my career. It's just, like, Herodotus is so interesting. Now, as always, let's finish off with a 5-star review from one of you amazing listeners. This one comes from a user called mgarcia9 in the States and is particularly relevant today. This was so perfect. Amazing! I almost caught up on the show and I have absolutely loved it. I love the way you tell stories, and my favorite episodes are the Greek plays that you go through. Thank you for doing this and making them so enjoyable. Thank you. And thank you for naming the plays. I fucking love the plays. I'm so glad that you all love the plays too, because there are so many left that I haven't told you yet. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians. She is my assistant producer. Laura Smith is now the production assistant and audio engineer. Laura is working on getting the website to actually have, like, lists of the episodes on each topic and, like, guests. All this stuff that I should have had, but it was too much work for just me and Michaela. So here we go. Select music used in today's episode was by Luke Chaos. Luke made me some incredible new music recently, and I've barely had the chance to use it because my COVID brain just didn't allow me to do new things, so I'm so happy to have it now. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you will get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. I am Liv, and I love Euripides so fucking much. I just want to go back in time and talk to him. I want him to be my best friend.
something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.